Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Reckoning with Slavery, Gender, Kinship, and Capitalism in the Early Black Atlantic by Jennifer L. Morgan. Narrated by Angel Peen. Publisher's Note. This audiobook will refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface. Sometime in the years before 1585 in the town of Bologna, Italy, the woman on the print edition cover of this book sat for a portrait painted by a man who would become famous. I won't give you his name because it's not important to the story that I'm trying to tell. I can't tell you hers, although her anonymity is at the very heart of the story that I'm trying to tell. She is dressed well, and she holds an ornate clock that may indicate the kind of wealthy household she was a part of. The painting was damaged, so we do not know who else was in the portrait, only that, at one point, she was not alone. If you look closely at the bodice of her gown, you will see straight pins. She may or may not have sewed the dress in the decorative collar she wears. She may or may not have been a seamstress. She may or may not have been paid for her labor. She may or may not have been free. Hundreds of Africans, both enslaved and free, were in Italy at the end of the 16th century. At the time when the woman was painted, the legality of African enslavability had circulated around the Mediterranean for almost 150 years. But art historians don't know who this woman is. They can't. Black woman with a clock. Slave woman with a clock. African woman with a clock. The portrait has been variously titled, most recently as Portrait of an African Woman Holding a Clock. Annibale Carracci, 1583/5. She marks time with the object that she holds, but marks so much more time with the gaze that holds us. Her visage conveys nothing if not knowing. She knows who she is in relation to the painter. She knows what she sees. She locks eyes with her viewers and comes close to dismissing us with the turn of her lip, dismissing, perhaps, our questions about who she is. When I look at her, I see someone who understands her own value, both the value that can't be quantified and that which can. I see a woman who reaches out across the centuries to say, "Look at me, and see what brought me here." What follows is my effort to do so. Introduction. Refusing Demography. In the 1640s, as a child, Elizabeth Key found herself misidentified on an estate in Virginia. A white boy named John Key called her Black Bessie. Overhearing it, the overseer's wife checked him and said, "Sirrah, you must call her sister, for she is your sister." Whereupon, the said John Key did call her sister. Key, the daughter of a free white Englishman and an enslaved African woman, occupied a space in 17th century Virginia in which she could simultaneously be Black Bessie and the sister of a white boy. In this space, a black woman could claim ties of kinship that would be recognized and legislated, but this was both anomalous and temporary. In the coming years, the logic of the paternal link formally unraveled as hereditary racial slavery congealed. Kinship could be claimed only in freedom. And by the middle of the 17th century in the English colonies, blackness generally signified freedom's opposite. At some point in the late 1620s, the free white Englishman Thomas Key, a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses, had impregnated Elizabeth's enslaved African-born mother. With this woman, who was never actually named, appearing only as woman slave in the documentary record, hoped or believed about her daughter's future is utterly lost. What is clear is that Thomas Key's death threw that future into some confusion. Although Elizabeth had been placed in indenture as a child, after her father's death she, or her indenture, was sold to another Virginia landowner. Selling the remaining term of an indenture was not uncommon, but because she was the daughter of an African woman, her race made her vulnerable to abuses from which an English woman would have been protected. Although the English had embraced the system of African slavery elsewhere in the Atlantic, in Virginia, they relied on indentured servants, the vast majority of whom were themselves English. In the 1650s, there were fewer than 300 Africans in the colony, or about 1% of the population of English settlers. There were many people like Elizabeth Key, women and men of African origin or descent, whose lives detoured from the trajectory of brutal racial slavery associated with Black people in the Americas. For the historian Ira Berlin, Key would count as an Atlantic Creole, a person who traversed the Atlantic in relative or absolute freedom in a milieu that was soon to generate hardened categories of racial subjugation. While Berlin didn't discuss Key in the landmark article where he introduced the notion of the Atlantic Creole, she would fit squarely in his exploration of 17th century colonial Virginia and the Tidewater Free Blacks he does name. In the late 16th and early 17th centuries, in Europe and in European colonies in the Americas, such individuals could acquire land, other forms of wealth, and the mobility conferred by these. The experiences of these women and men demonstrate the uneven development of racial hierarchy in the Atlantic world, a reminder that racial categories could be less fixed than they appeared. Along with the work of Berlin, historical biographies written by scholars like James Sweet, Linda Haywood, and Vincent Coretta similarly seek to wrench Black lives from the chokehold of the history of slavery. Similarly, Rebecca Getz and others have carefully interrogated the history of race in the early Atlantic world in pursuit of the nuances that historicizing race reveals. Key understood that she was in danger, that her color could indeed dictate her status. Key spent her life assessing the terrain of race, inheritance, value, slavery, and freedom in the 17th century world, which was at once a localized space configured around the English Atlantic, and also part and parcel of a multicultural, multi-imperial universe. She lived in a community that accepted her paternal lineage, but kinship faltered when its members were asked to testify about her status. Some said she was a slave, some that she was free, and some that she was indentured. She had a child, fathered by a free white Englishman, but this brought no clarity. When she petitioned the court to affirm her freedom in 1655, she clearly had a precise understanding of how her statuses as a woman, as a mother, and as a descendant of an enslaved African intersected. Her suit was granted, then overturned, and finally won when the Englishman who was the father of her child brought her case to the General Assembly. After she was deemed free, the two wed, their marriage a buttress to the freedom of her descendants, as well as to her own. For historians, the fact that she prevailed shows that in 17th century Virginia, racialized categories of enslavement were neither inevitable nor hardened. In the history that follows, within which Key was situated, the life circumstances and experiences of those defined as Black were already brutally marked. The transatlantic slave trade had already indelibly shaped notions of race, the market, and the family. By the mid-17th century, the underlying forces structuring the slave trade were steadfastly shaping ideas of difference, commerce, and kinship. This is not an argument opposed to historicizing the concept of race. Rather, it brings kinship and commodification to bear on 17th-century ideologies to ask both how the obscene logics of racial slavery came to make sense to Europeans, and also what Africans and their descendants in the early modern Atlantic could and did know about the terms of their captivity. It is also an effort to dislodge the English Atlantic from its Anglophone perch by placing it firmly in the longer history of the Atlantic. To understand Key and the forces she navigated, we must conceive of a history in which the notions of heredity, motherhood, commodity, and race all cohered in and on the body of the daughter of an enslaved African woman and a free Englishman. For Key, the case rested on the assumption that effective relationships, those between father and daughter, husband and wife, mother and children, would prove a bulwark against the intrusions of the commercial market into her and her children's lives and labors. Historians are accustomed to thinking of Key as a woman enmeshed in these relationships, not as an economic thinker, a person versed in political arithmetic, speculative thought, and social calculation. Yet economic concerns were the source of danger for Key, and economic concerns drove the legislators to revisit this case less than a decade later. In 1662, the colonial legislators reconvened to decree that in all future cases, the condition of a child born to an African woman and a free man would follow that of the mother. Negro women's children to serve according to the condition of the mother. Act 12, and Henning, Statutes at Large, 170. The law was soon adopted by all English colonies as they defined the status of the enslaved. It stood as law until the abolition of slavery in 1863. As English colonial settlers legislated new economic formulations that extended masters' property rights to other humans, they brought matters of intimacy and effect out of the household and into the marketplace. Using arguments based in law, religion, and race, they located Africans and their descendants in ledgers and bills of sale, not as members of households or families. This social transformation was saturated with both spectacular violence and the brutality of everyday cruelties. The insinuation of economic rationality into colonial intimacies is the crux of the matter. The mechanisms and ideas that emerged in the early modern Atlantic world situated economy and kinship as not just distinct, but antithetical. As anthropologist Claude Myasu noted more than three decades ago, slavery produced social relations that are the antithesis of kinship relations. On the other side of the Atlantic, Hortense Spiller suggested that if scholars were to overlap kinlessness on the requirements of property, it could enlarge our understanding of what enslavement entailed. Examining the Key case from these perspectives, we see that it refracted the gradual recognition among colonial legislators that intimacy needed to be carefully navigated because kinship posed dangers for an economic system in which race demarcated human beings as property. The intimacy that concerned slave-owning legislators was sexual. But as the cultural theorist Lisa Lowe has argued, intimacy is a framework that reveals the relatedness of phenomena that have been constructed as distinct and unrelated. For Lowe, those categories are liberalism, the slave trade, settler colonialism in the Americas, and the China and East Indies trade. She mobilizes intimacy as a category that exceeds the spheres of sexuality and household relations, writing that she uses the concept of intimacy as a heuristic and a means to observe the historical division of world processes into those that develop modern liberal subjects and modern spheres of social life, and those processes that are forgotten, cast as failed or irrelevant because they do not produce value legible within modern classifications. Reckoning with slavery is similarly concerned with the processes that divide people and economies along distinct axes of value and commodity. I draw on Lowe's methodological intervention to consider the relationship between early modern concepts of numeracy, slavery, and kinship in constructing the rationale for hereditary racial slavery and in positioning African women as particularly eligible, both historically and archivally. Doing so highlights the range of meanings attached to Key, her children, and her legal case. Virginia lawmakers faced the quotidian consequences of sex between free subjects and those who were or could be enslaved. Key assumed she had a kinship relationship to her father. Her freedom suit was rooted in the notion that his paternal line was hers to claim. However, in the context of a labor system wherein white men routinely, and possibly systematically, raped the women they claimed as property, their own paternity could not devolve to their children. Indeed, in this system, only women who were the daughters of free white men and white women could convey kinship, and thus freedom, to their children. The legislative intervention associated with Key's case did more than just clarify the heritability of slavery. It also assigned legitimacy to white women's kinship ties and white men's property claims. The inability to convey kinship, to have family represent something other than the expansion of someone else's estate, is at issue here. If the children of white men and African women could assert their freedom, the primacy of property claims would be dislodged. But Englishmen did not want their property rights unsettled by sexual congress. Reproduction, and thus enslavability, was tethered to enslavement in a way that foreclosed the possibility that kinship might destabilize capital. To be enslaved meant to be locked into a productive relationship whereby all that your body could do was harnessed to accumulate capital for another. In this case, sex, inheritance, property, race, and commodification were both displayed and delineated as the House of Burgesses amplified its core assumptions about the nature of racial inheritance in the New World. Scholars who analyze the 1662 Code reanimate the word condition as we discuss the implications of the rule that the condition of the child would follow that of the mother. But I am compelled to push back against that word and the stasis it invokes. In the historian Vincent Brown's engagement with Orlando Patterson's concept of social death, he concludes that instead of understanding slavery as a condition, we should see it as a predicament in which enslaved Africans and their descendants never cease to pursue a politics of belonging, mourning, accounting, and regeneration. For Brown, the notion of social death as the condition of slavery fixes the enslaved person too statistically in the category. I too want to problematize social death as a static condition that evokes, but doesn't actually engage with the maternal figure who is incapable of counteracting natal alienation. I suggest here that enslaved parents understood the potential birth of children as a predicament that clarified the foundations on which their enslavement was erected. The violence that suffused that predicament was regularized, and indeed world-defining. In her critical formulation of social death, which she renders as zombie biopolitics, Elizabeth Dillon has argued that such violence produced the resourced, white, genealogically reproductive, legally substantiated, Enlightenment man. The archival silences around the lived experiences of enslaved women at the birth of racial capitalism are themselves the technologies that rendered those women as outside history, feeling, and intellect. How were race, inheritance, trade, freedom, value, and slavery condensed in the competing desires of white men and of black women and men, as the former sought to retain property and persons by destroying kinship, and the latter sought to produce families opposed to that destruction? Both white elites and the women whose corporeal integrity was so profoundly violated by the rule of property understood, experienced, and responded to these new ideas in ways that we still do not fully understand. Women who lived through the early decades of enslavement saw the identity of their children and the assumptions that governed their futures change drastically. That shift was rooted in a relatively new set of ideas concerning trade, value, population, and commodification, all of which might qualify as forms of numeracy. Spillers wrote in 1987 that the captive body becomes the site of a metaphor for value that renders useless any distinction between the literal and figurative violences that enslaved persons were subjected to. Further, as I argue in this book, the metaphors of value and valuelessness owe at least part of their power to the knowledge regimes set in motion by the transatlantic slave trade. Rational equivalence was increasingly understood as the antithesis of social, emotional, or familial categories, which were simultaneously delimited as the sole purview of Europeans. As a result, African women and their descendants, all members of families, were locked together into the very space that built a market based on the denial that they were there. This book argues that perhaps it is possible to discern the developments that brought these categories into being in the modern world when we examine them from the point of view of these women. How does the concept of value, or currency, or marketing connect with the experience of being enslaved? How did enslaved people interpret the illusory claims of rationality when such claims laid a price on both their heads and those of their unborn children? As early as 1971, the scholar and activist Angela Davis asked historians to consider the trauma that enslaved women experienced when they had to surrender childbearing to alien and predatory economic interests. Answering such questions calls for a research strategy that takes as its starting point the assumption that both enslaved Africans and their captors simultaneously enacted meanings as they navigated the very new terrain of hereditary racial slavery and its consequences. By examining the moments when ideas about rationality and race appear to cohere, we can unearth the lived experiences and analytic responses to enslavement of those whose lives have most regularly and consistently fallen outside the purview of the archive. The question, as posed by the anthropologist Stephen Palmier, is, how did enslaved women and men not just experience, but actively analyze and render comprehensible the violent transformations wrought upon them? Being locked into a juridical category of perpetual servitude based on an inherited status had particular meaning for those who produced that inheritance inside their own bodies. To return to Davis's important work, enslaved women were positioned to attain a practical awareness of both the slave owner's power and the slave owner's dependence on her productive and reproductive body. Thus, these women embodied both the apex of slavery's oppressive extractions and its potential undoing. If we assume that Elizabeth Key entered the House of Burgesses with little ability to comprehend the calculus working on and through her, we overlook her relationship to and understanding of all that was unfolding around her. She was embedded in a foundational epoch from which race, forced labor, capitalism, and modern economies emerged. While the actions she undertook to protect her children show that she did not see herself as commodified, they offer tacit proof that she saw that some around her were. What can we learn from the moments when those being commodified catch the process in action? From actions that reveal layers of meaning and complexities. It is obvious that Key experienced this transformation, but might she have formulated thoughts about what she glimpsed? The 17th century English Atlantic world was a tangle of overlapping hierarchies, ideas of difference, and newly sharpened ideas about rationality and value. Concepts about race entwined with those about value, and ideas about inheritance with those about social reproduction and childbirth in ways that we still do not adequately understand. Thus, we need to re-examine the new ideas about commerce, finance, value, and money that came to be understood as the heart of what was rational, knowable, and scientific. In the early modern period, the number of people in England with numerical literacy increased significantly across the population, including among the writers and critical thinkers of the time. Keith Thomas argues that the field of 17th century political arithmetic emerged from a faith in the power of statistics to resolve the problem of government and administration, but it was also the product of a faith in the work that rationality could do. Faced with the notion that an investment in forced labor could become a valuable asset for individuals and for the nation, Europeans ascribed stable value to black bodies as commodities and claimed that the province of assessing value belonged only to whites, that is, to those who came to see themselves primarily as white. However, if we read race back onto political arithmetic, its faulty calculus and claims to logical certitude become increasingly apparent, as do the roots of racial thinking at its core. There was nothing purely rational about the turn to racial slavery, regardless of the wealth it produced. Yet the self-evidence of that statement still requires a caveat concerning the role of racism in rendering slavery irrational. In the arena of culture, racial slavery made no sense. In the realm of the economy, however, it did. Locating the connections between the history of difference and the history of value demands a recognition that ideas about value developed alongside other concepts that were meant to position economics as the site of rationality and knowability. The same process that led the accounts of courts, trade, commerce, and governments to be archived ended with no accounting at all of the lived experiences of Africans as commodities, of the lives of 17th century African women and their descendants. In A History of the Modern Fact, Mary Poovey asks us to map the complex history of the relationship between numerical representation and figurative language. In this foundational text, Poovey completely omits any discussion of race and its connection to the accumulation of wealth in early modern Europe. And in Wizards and Scientists, Palmier worries that the truly stunning wealth of aggregate data on slavery and the slave trade may form a mounting heap of abstract knowledge that may well contribute to blocking from view the ghosts of the men and women who are our concern. It is impossible to approach the histories of slavery and gender without confronting the problem of the archive. As Marissa Fuentes has generatively shown, doing so requires us to understand that enslaved women appear as historical subjects through the form and content of archival documents and the manner in which they lived, spectacularly violated, objectified, disposable, hypersexualized, and silenced. The violence is transferred from the enslaved bodies to the documents that count, condemn, assess, and evoke them, and we receive them in this condition. Fuentes's observations are crucial. The processes she describes apply to the production of these women and the production of the ideas that situated them as counted and condemned. Before we received these women, they were captured by the Atlantic market through a set of ideas and practices that enabled the damage white people did to them and ensured that such damage could only result in archival obscurity. Making visible the process by which this happened is as important as recognizing the problem of its outcome. If the archives make it impossible to receive African women as other than historically obscure, damaged, and violated, then redressing that damage requires a clear understanding of what situated them as such. And while the manifestation...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?